Okay, guys, we are here at the When Hard Work Beats Talent podcast. Our first guest is amazing. I am proud and honored to know her, Coach KJ Kindler. Coach, welcome to our podcast, and thank you for being the first guest.
Thank you for having me. I didn't realize I was first, but I'm proud to be first.
You are number one. We wanted to go start this thing with a bang, so you are number one. So we were talking earlier that I was going to read your bio. However, when I printed it off of the OU website, it was 7 pages long. So we're just going to hit the highlights. So if you know KJ Kindler, you know that she's led OU to 6 national titles, 14 consecutive regional titles, 14 Big 12 titles, have coached countless All-Americans, a bunch of national champions, and just all around amazing coach. So we all know that in the gymnastics world, it's not, it is just commonplace. You and your staff have been together for 18 years and you're amazing. However, this podcast, we are going to dive into things that you may not know about Coach KJ Kindler. Some things you may not want to know about KJ Kindler. You know, it's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. But with each podcast we are starting, we're going to start with just 5 quick questions out the gate. So question one, what is one hidden talent you have?
I'm going to give you 2.
Oh, nice.
I make great soup.
Okay. Well, that's
only
great
thing I can make. It's the only thing I can make in the kitchen, but I make great soup. You know why? Because you don't have to tend to it. Right? It just go. Like once it starts going, I can walk away and start doing something else. So I make great soup and I can pick up anything with my toes.
No way. My Beth can do the same thing. And it drives me crazy. But I think it's got to be a mom thing because she can pick up socks off the floor. She can pick up anything with her toes. And then Dixie's been able to do the same thing.
I'm not that talented, so those were the only 2 things I can think of.
So what's the favorite kind of soup you make?
Yeah.
Chicken and wild rice. I'm from Minneapolis originally, and chicken and wild rice soup is like the soup.
Ooh, nice.
I make chicken and dumpling too.
Ooh.
And lasagna soup and tortellini soup. Oh, it's really good.
This I did not know.
Well, yeah. That's the point of the questions, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's one of the questions. I'm kind of excited.
Try some soup here at some point. Well, the next question is what's one place you've been that you'll never go back to?
I can think of 2. The first, I can think of 4. Disneyland. Oh my gosh. Never want to go back there ever. It's so crowded. I don't like crowds. I don't like waiting in line. I'm very impatient. And it's hot, and all they offer is hot dogs and corn dogs, and yeah, I'm not a fan of Disneyland, to be quite honest. I know that's probably a terrible un-American answer.
No, at all.
I think it would be. We have not taken the kids to Disney World or Disneyland yet because it kind of freaks me out, and I just don't want to deal with the people.
Same thing.
Stressful, it's anxiety. Yeah. And then when I was out of college, I went traveling in Europe, backpacking for 6 weeks. And there was one place we went, I never want to go back, and it's Amsterdam.
Really?
That place scared me so bad.
Interesting.
The red light district was very scary to me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so
I've
was
heard
the
about
hostel
that.
I stayed in. Not good.
Not very hospitable, huh?
I stayed in hostels, so there were like 120 beds in the room, and they were all bunk beds, and it was just a crazy experience. But I'd also never like to go back to the Atlanta airport or the Charlotte airport, but I have to go back, so that doesn't answer the question.
Yeah, Atlanta is awful for me. It's Chicago O'Hare. That place is nightmare.
I've been skipping that one.
I don't mind. Yeah, either. I don't like Atlanta.
Well, but when Dixie was 3, we went and had to connect. This is what I'll tell you. We were going from Florida to Chicago O'Hare to come back to Oklahoma City. Makes sense, right?
Not good planning.
No. But our flight in Florida was delayed, so we missed our connecting flight in O'Hare. We got stuck in O'Hare overnight. And so we stayed in their Cot City overnight. It was awesome. But she,
who's your Dixie travel did great. Agent?
Beth. Wouldn't rather not say.
It's his wife. That's why. Hopefully she doesn't listen to this.
I'm sure she won't.
But, no, I mean, to be fair, we decided that we were looking at the ticket prices, and it was literally $600 cheaper for us to drive to Wichita and fly out of Wichita. So with a lot of tickets and just Dixie, we didn't have Clancy at the time. We were like, listen, we're not going to spend $600 in gas money going from Wichita to Oklahoma City. So let's just fly out of Wichita. What could go wrong? That went wrong. You're flying through O'Hare.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare.
And so, $11 to get a nonstop.
Yeah, exactly. All righty. So what is your guilty pleasure?
Oh, I mean, I don't have a lot of them. I would say chocolate. Is that a guilty pleasure? I don't feel that guilty when I eat it.
No, me neither. I feel great.
And maybe like red wine. Wine.
Mm-hmm.
A glass of wine.
Nothing wrong with it.
No, I don't think I have anything super guilty.
Well, I mean, with what your career, what you do, it makes sense. You burn enough calories being out on the mat, keeping everybody busy, that you probably can get away with doing that. Somebody who like me, who's very sedentary, I can't get away with eating chocolate because it would you would tell in a hurry.
Well, the problem is I like chocolate too much, and I've passed that on to my at least Clancy, and I love chocolate. Except for German chocolate, can't stand the coconuts.
Well, the next question is, who is the most surprising person to have an impact on your life?
So, I mean, thinking about this, I could pick a million gymnastics people or people in my business and in my industry that have had a really strong impact on my life. But the most surprising person and actually had a huge impact on me is probably someone I met in college, and his name is Dean Vaccaro, and he was a DJ in Minneapolis, and he cut my very first floor music that I performed to, and he kind of taught me how to, and he did it on a record player back then. I mean, now we use computers, but like we were literally pressing pause and pressing play, and it was tedious, okay? And I met him through a friend. And because he was a DJ, he was into, I mean, this was the 80s and 90s, guys. So he was into tons of really awesome music that I loved. He introduced me to tons of new music, and he still does. Like, he literally texts me probably daily or sends me a song. But he just introduced me to a lot of different kinds of music. He taught me a lot about music. Music became a big part of my life. As you know, I do all the choreography for the team. I cut all the floor music myself. So he really did have like a big influence on my career. And I have a very eclectic love for music. I love kind of all genres. I can appreciate all genres. And I think it's because of him. And, you know, he worked at a big dance club in Minneapolis, and I went to it. It was, well, he went to one Pacific Club was one, and the other one was called Rogue. And we used to go and just literally dance all night. I don't think people do that anymore, but so that was a really fun part of my life. And he really kind of got me going on my musical, you know, my love for music. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Would not have guessed that one.
No. Man. I mean, a lot of awesome. People wouldn't know that.
No.
Lou would probably know, and that's about it. A couple of my friends definitely from college.
Lou would know that. Being your husband and all.
He's never asked me this question.
Well, to be fair, I've never asked Beth these questions, and she helped us come up with the questions.
Tonight, you're going to ask her all these questions.
I'm going to ask her all these questions.
It will be marital bonding.
Look, you're helping out a marriage, too.
Okay. I know.
But Only is she a national champion coach, she's also a marriage counselor. So she can have that her business card. That'll be in the next line.
My retirement plan. My retirement plan.
You're too young to retire. You've got lots of years left.
Yeah, she has at least 10 years left.
Oh, boy.
You can do it, coach. Retire.
I'm not going to be going out onto the floor with a walker. I won't do it.
You won't need to. I mean, there's plenty of coaches out there not doing that. Okay, last question for our rapid fire. What is the hardest thing you have had to overcome?
I mean, I've been super blessed in my life. I have had obstacles in my life, adversities in my life. There's probably two things. The first thing probably was my very last competition. Obviously, gymnastics is a huge part of my life. It was when I was an athlete. And my last competition was pitiful, really. And I reflect back on it because there's nothing I can do about it. You know, a lot of times you run into obstacles and adversity that you can learn from and get better from. It was my very last competition. So there was really no way to remedy it. So it kind of haunts me a little bit. There's lots of mistakes and errors I made probably leading up to that competition that I keep in the forefront of my mind doing other things in my life. Like, so I think that's definitely one of them. But the second was leaving Iowa State. That was really difficult for me. I'd been there 18 years. I'm a very loyal person. I wasn't loyal to the institution, even though I was an alum. I was loyal to the people. And my dad always told me, you're not loyal to institutions, you're loyal to people. And it was so hard to leave that team. And they were number one. You know, I had seniors that were, I had recruited and really had great relationships with, and it was incredibly difficult. But what I knew was that it was never going to be a good time to leave. There was never going to be the perfect moment. I was never not going to leave people behind. And so I either had to make the decision to go for it and hope that they would eventually understand. I knew they wouldn't immediately. And so that was super difficult. But now, you know, I have good relationships with a lot of them. Most of them as adults now really understand why I had to take this opportunity. So basically what I was hoping for was forgiveness when I made that decision. And eventually I think I got it, but I think that first year was really hard for them. And it was hard for me, you know, to watch them. I don't know if you know this story, Ryan, but that team was great. They made the Super Six. When I left, they had made the Super Six the year before. The seniors were amazing. And at regional championships with Oklahoma, my very first year, you know, and this is how you make the NCAA championship. And we've never missed the NCAA championship since I've been at Oklahoma, but we tied Iowa State and the top two teams went and we tied for second. And honestly, we had no business tying them. They were a better team. You know, I had coached them. I knew how good they were. Their freshman class was amazing, but we tied them. And I went back in the locker room and laid on my back with my feet to the ceiling. The team doc came in because they have to do a tiebreaker and they have to add up all the scores, all six on every event to find out which team makes it. And so while they were doing that, I went in the locker room, laid down, feet to the ceiling, and I was thinking, I can't lose to them. And that's just what I was thinking. I can't do that, you know, but I laid down and the team doc came in and he's like, are you okay? He took my pulse. I'm like, I'm fine. And then my trainer came in and said, we won. I'm like, yeah. Okay. So that was like the craziest moment ever. But I felt terrible for my seniors who weren't moving on at Iowa State too. And we had a moment after that meet. They were all crying and came up to me and it was bittersweet. It was just bittersweet. So anyway, those were probably my two.
But now looking back on it, you've been at OU going on your 18th year.
19th, right? This year.
19th.
I'm going on 19. I just finished 18th.
Longer than Iowa State.
Yes.
Is that when you first came, when you and Lou came to OU with Tom and Trainer Jen, did you ever imagine you'd be here that long?
Yeah, I knew this was the final stop for sure. I like I said, I'm a very loyal person, and investing in a program and creating a culture and it honestly continuing that culture every year is a challenge, especially with the changing characters that are on your team every year and the different personalities that you work with. So you don't just develop a culture and there it is and it just stays. You know, you have to work at it every single year. There's a lot of moving pieces. So yeah, we wanted to come and put our roots in and definitely invest in the final step of our careers. So yes, I did think I would be here till the end. I don't know. Unless Joe gets rid of me, I'm here.
Joe would be crazy to get rid of you. He'd be nuts. Yeah. Six national titles.
He didn't go hire coaches to get rid of him. Yeah. You're obviously doing something really right. You mentioned, and we were just talking right here about errors. When you have one of your athletes who commits an error some form or fashion, they kind of get down on themselves, what does that conversation look like between you and them to get them to that right place for that next event?
Yeah. So honestly, we talk about even in training, because in practice, you go through the same thing. You know, you may go to bars and have a really rough day. You got to put it behind you or else you're going to create a monster of a day for yourself that you have to somehow rebound from the next day. So putting that event behind you, starting fresh, moving forward, they have to be able to do that. Just like anybody else in athletics, you know, you have to move on to the next play. You can't dwell on the interception or whatever happened before, because when you start doing that, you know, the wheels come off pretty darn fast. So they have to really be able to move on, you know, and the conversation probably looks very diplomatic, you know, talking through it a little bit, but also I'll give them a break if they need one, like go take a break, you know, get your mind fresh, get your mind straight, and then come back out and do what you do, because sometimes you just need a reset. And very often you need some time alone to make that happen, you know, talk yourself into it, talk yourself out of it, whatever you have to do in the locker room. So I think sometimes that's probably my best tactic, is just take a break, reset, and then come back out. And I understand, listen, the challenges for these women are great. You know, I have very high functioning women on my team. We had the highest GPA at the University of Oklahoma of all the sports with a 3.64 this semester. Like, these are women who are trying to get straight A's, 11 women with 4.0s this semester. Like, they just are high functioning. And so they have a perfectionist mindset, many of them. And so one small mistake can send them off the rails sometimes, because they just expect so much of themselves. It's probably the biggest demon of gymnastics is the perfect 10 and the perfectionism of it. So we really have to work hard at that, not just in meets, but in practice. I feel like if you can do it in practice, doing it in a meet becomes easier, because this is a team-oriented sport. I think a lot of people think of it as individual. You're up there alone, and it's certainly difficult to be up there alone, but these women have to buy into the team concept, and it does add pressure, you know, to their performances. So they have to know that, you know, we're going to the next event and it's for the team, and you need to, how you respond to that mistake says everything about you, you know, and I say that all the time to them, especially in meets. They'll come off, you know, I did it at Nationals. Ava came off beam and I was hugging her, and in her ear, I said, "It's okay. How you respond to this is what matters." And she knew that. She had to go down in that corral and cheer her head off for the next person and not disengage. And that's hard to do. These kids are young, and she feels bad. You know, she feels terrible that she had that error. And she's disappointed. And you have to be able to quickly compartmentalize that disappointment and move on in literally 30 seconds. It's not an easy thing to do. And so we try to teach them that from the get-go, and it's a learning process.
My wife and I have two young boys. I say they're teenagers now. One's 14 and one's 11. And the youngest one has that mentality of being a perfectionist. He struggles if things don't go right. So we tried to find ways to kind of engage him and get him to like, okay, turn it off for a second, think about it. We came up with this kind of silly little thing called a PEP score for him because he likes to keep score because that's who he is. And it stands for positive attitude, effort, and performance. And it's a 10-point score. It's 4, 4, and 2. Like, I don't care about your performance. What I care about is a positive attitude and your effort because those two things will equal your performance. And so we talked to him before every game, like, listen, give me your best effort, give me your best attitude, and the rest of it will take care of itself. Like, I don't care if you score 2 goals because you play soccer or you score 12 goals. Like, I don't care. I want to see that you have your head up. You're looking to make the right pass. You're looking to being a good teammate. And it's been something for him personally that's been beneficial because it's helped him kind of evaluate. We'll ask him, hey, how was your effort? How was your attitude? Here's what your performance looked like. And it's kind of helped him, and we reward him when he is, you know, makes a 9 or a 10 on his PEP score. We'll go, you know, get ice cream or something like that because at 11 years old, ice cream solves all the world's problems.
Yes, that. It does.
Yeah.
It definitely does. And so let's go back to square one. Born in Minneapolis, what was it like living in the land of what I like to call not the land of lakes, but land of freezing cold temperatures in the wintertime?
I thought you were going to say the land of Prince.
No, freezing cold temperatures. Prince is another one, yes. But to be fair, it's freezing cold up there a lot of the times.
Yep, it's very cold. You know, my dad used to tell me I had to walk to school in snowdrifts that were 4 foot high. You know, and it's true. We lived on this hill and we had huge snow drifts, but it doesn't snow there as much anymore. I don't think they see that kind of weather as much as they did when I was younger. But I'm a cold person. So it wasn't that comfortable, to be quite honest with you, at least in the temperature department. But I mean, I loved Minnesota. The people are great. The winters are cold, but the summers are unbelievable. Like we would go up to Lake Superior a lot. We would go up to the Boundary Waters, which is up on the boundary of Canada and Minnesota. And we would go canoeing and camping. We were very outdoorsy. We had 6 kids in my family, so we had to do things that weren't super costly. You know, you couldn't pay for that many people to be going to Disneyland every year. Although he did bring us 1 year, which was remarkable, but it was beautiful there. I love it. And there was a place called Lutzen up on the North Shore, they call it, which is Lake Superior. And my brother actually ended up buying one of the cabins we used to stay in when we were little, and he built several cabins up there and rents them out. And
that's cool.
Yeah. It's his new venture. So, yeah, I love it up there.
So, of the 6 kids, where do you fit in that?
Guess.
I don't want to guess.
I will say.
I'm gonna say. Not the young. I'm gonna go with second oldest.
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 You're the oldest.
Yes.
You and I, okay, so I'm the oldest of 3 boys.
I'm the oldest as well.
Yeah.
My sister, the youngest, was born the day I left for college. And my dad had to leave the hospital, leave my mom in the hospital to drive me down to Iowa State. And he literally dumped me off in my dorm room, spent less than 15 minutes and was like, later.
Peace out. Peace out, Kathy Jo. I'm out.
And I was mortified. First of all, my mom wasn't there, you know, to say goodbye. And then my dad's like, ciao.
You're the oldest.
You're good.
Yeah.
I was fine.
That's the way it works. They just kind of drop you off on the deep end and say, good luck. And you're like,
yeah,
I'll make it work. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we give Clancy a hard time sometimes, because I'm the oldest, Beth's the oldest, Dixie's the oldest. So Clancy's full house of oldest kids. So we have to remind him, dude, it sucks being a baby, but we don't care.
Suck it up.
Suck it up.
Yeah. Yeah. We have two of each in our house. See, I'm the oldest and my wife's the baby of her family. Of course, then Eli's the oldest of ours and Cam's the baby. So we have that that dynamic of oldest and youngest. So my wife doesn't understand sometimes when I'm kind of like, I don't care. Is there a bone? Is there blood? No, then I don't care. Like,
right.
Yeah.
So growing up in Minnesota, when did you first get involved in the sport of gymnastics? And then taking a step further, when did you realize, okay, I think I want to do this and become a coach?
So I was 4 years old and I was in a baton class. And I did it in the basement of this woman's house. She literally had her own like program in the basement of her house, but she also had tumbling. And every time I would go in for baton and tap, by the way, tap lessons, I wanted to flip and I wanted to go do the tumbling class. And so the woman who owned it kept telling my mom, I don't think she's real talented in this baton stuff. But she really loves to tumble. I think you should put her in tumbling. So I was four. I started in the basement of this woman's house. Her name was Mary Jane Olson. And really, this is kind of how my story started, because Mary Jane Olson was the head coach of Hamline University. So she was the head gymnastics coach at the university, Hamline University, that was right there in Minnesota. It was a Division III school. And what she ended up doing was bringing that basement business she had going into the university program. So I grew up watching these Division III collegiate gymnasts compete. And I also did club gymnastics right there at the university. So I had this unique opportunity to kind of watch that from the get-go. I think that's probably was the beginning of wanting to be a coach at a collegiate level, and watching her as a woman in the 70s, very rare to have a female head coach in the 70s really excel in the way that she did. And she was a legend in Minnesota. You know, there was another small school, Gus Davis, which is in St. Peter, Minnesota, and they were rivals. And like, I was all into it. So I think that's when I first was exposed to college gymnastics and like fell in love with it. But I started doing my own choreography when I was in eighth grade. I started at my club. I then moved to Connecticut after that and did my junior and senior year in Connecticut. And I had a different club there. And a different coach there. So I kind of learned the best of both worlds. My first coach was really made me love it. You know, she made me love the sport. I couldn't get enough. We call it a gym rat. I was a gym rat. I was in there all the time, last to leave, first there, never wanted to leave. And she just developed this love for it. I was never bored. It was never mundane. Then I went to this club in Connecticut and the coach was very structured and very technical. And so I was able to learn the other side of the sport and discipline, because the first one wasn't really all that disciplined. It was like, you just did it because you loved it and you went crazy. So I kind of got this great balance that I think a lot of people don't get in their sport. I got both sides. And so when I went to Connecticut, I was doing my own choreography. I also did high school gymnastics in Connecticut, which you were allowed to do both. And oh, wow. That was really, so I was on a team for the first time, that felt like a college team might, and had a lot of success with gymnastics, there. So I don't know. It just kind of was this perfect storm of my development that, you know, put me in this great place, I think. And when I went to Iowa State, I started coaching right away. I was walk-on. And so I had to pay for my way. And I started coaching at a club right away and developing. Like, I had my own compulsory team. And, like, my goal was to win the state meet and, you know, doing all that. So, and my head coach at the time really fostered that, you know, that need in me to want to coach, even though I was still going to school. I was doing a lot at the time, but I don't know. So I'm not sure right when I wanted to be a coach, but I think it was just this long process of meeting incredible people who really helped me along the way. And I respected those people so much. And I think that just kind of, you know, created that inspiration in me to want to do the same for someone else.
You seem like you are always on the go and very busy. How do you personally decompress from what you do so you can be the best version of yourself when you're working with your high level athletes?
This is a really hard question. I'm not very balanced. And I think balance is like a farce. You can't be balanced. So everyone's always saying you need to find balance, you know, and I'm always thinking in my head, how do you find balance when your mind's always thinking of the next best thing to do, you know? And so it's difficult for me to decompress. But I would say, like, I don't know, more recently, you know, exercising, going on walks, things like that, spending time with my kids, those little things, those little moments probably are the best. But I don't have anything consistent, I don't think.
And it looks right. Different for every person. For what decompresses you might not work for me or for Ryan, mm-hmm. but if it helps you get to the place where you have a clear head and you can do what you need to do, then obviously that is some sort of balance for you personally and professionally, so that you can be who you are striving to be on a daily basis. Because obviously it's working. You're winning, and you're recruiting high level athletes to come to you because they see that you're able to take them from where they are to where they want to go. So it's obviously working.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
It's working. since you started coaching back in, what was 92 at Iowa State, how has your coaching evolved, and how has that athlete evolved from back then to where it is now?
Oh my gosh. I made so many mistakes. You start young like that, and I'll be honest, I literally graduated on Saturday and had a job on Monday. I mean, that's how fast it came. My head coach quit in December. Who quits, you know, a collegiate sport in December right before the season starts? Well, what I didn't realize is he was really grooming me for that assistant coach position the entire fall. And the assistant coach became the head coach. And we were interim, you know, when we first started. And I don't know, like, I was their friend, kind of. These were my teammates. It was very difficult at first. But they did respect me as an athlete. And so, you know, I worked very hard. I had earned a scholarship. I loved gymnastics. They knew all those things about me. So I think that they had some level of respect for me. So I was able to pull it off, because a lot of people, I think, coming right out of college have hard time, you know, with the boundary of coach versus friend. And that's certainly difficult when you're 22. So I had to work at it a little bit, but it was amazing. Like, it was so much learning to do, especially in those first, I don't know, 10 years, I would say. Like, so many mistakes I made, I can't even tell you. And I'm sure the athletes can tell you how many mistakes I made. Learn every time you make a mistake, you learn from it. You're like, I'm not doing that again, or I can't do that, or that was a bad decision. And I thank the athletes who were there at that time. They allowed me to learn on them, you know. It was invigorating. Like, I was a sponge. I wanted to learn everything about technique and everything about coaching and everything about motivating. And I mean, it was pretty amazing. I don't know, but everything has evolved so much since then. But I would say, you know, learning from your mistakes directs you a great deal. Anyone who walks into their job the first time and thinks that they know what they're doing, you know, that's a mistake. But I still make mistakes is the thing, you know, there's new mistakes to make all the time. And you always reflect, like, when something goes wrong, I take ownership for that immediately. That is, I have to go through, you know, my list of what could I have done better? Where did I go wrong? How could I have changed or altered that result so that it was better, you know, or it had maybe gone a different direction? What will I do differently next time so that this athlete isn't in this position? Because I think looking in the mirror is the first thing you have to do when you're a head coach. You know, you have a lot of people depending on you and you're at the helm, you know, you're directing the program. So it's really important to look inside and kind of see what you could, how you can grow and how you can change. So I'm a stubborn person, you know, but I'm not so stubborn that I can't take ownership or accountability for what's going on. And maybe that stubbornness has helped me do that. But I would say, you know, I it's hard to put into words how much I've changed. Probably my young, I'm might be a little easier now. Maybe if you talk to some of my first athletes, I was tougher, you know, I had less flexibility when I was younger, you know, oh, it's gotta be done this way. And I learned that I needed to be more flexible. I needed to mold my training to the individual. It's not a blanket training plan for all 20 of these women. I've got to mold it to each individual. They're all different. They all have different strengths. I mean, I could go on and on of different aspects, you know, but I would just say, you know, it's been an evolution.
That's what one of my wife is a teacher or educator. And she said that, you know, her way she dealt with younger people is it changed when she had kids because she saw these children and young adults as somebody's kid now instead of just a student. And it kind of changed her perception or her viewpoint on how to kind of manage expectations and realities. Kind of leading into my next question is when you're recruiting, you've been doing this now for just a hot minute. So you've had opportunity to sit down in front of parents and have these conversations. Is there ever just a moment you're like, yep, that's the kid? Or is, oh yeah, this is not the right person for this school at this point, even though we've had opportunity to talk. Do you have that kind of sixth sense about you now that you've been doing it for a few years that you know what good looks like?
Yes. So it's easy to evaluate talent and to see, you know, you can look at statistics all day long and you can look at the numbers and you can look at where someone's finished at nationals and all of those things that are tangible. Okay. But when you go and first of all, the conversations I have on the phone are really important because I'm learning about the person, not the athlete. And when you go and meet the families and you field their questions say a lot, you know, what they ask, what they're interested in knowing about, those kind of things you really have to be in tune to. And I can sense whether someone's a good fit for our culture. Absolutely. I can also sense, you know, I was talking to Ryan about this earlier, and athletes, the intangibles, an athlete's self-confidence, an athlete's gamer qualities just by watching a workout and an athlete's communication style, things like that, that I have to be in tune to because there has to be a good fit, right? With the transfer portal these days, and we know it's crazy, like retention's very important to me. I want to pick the people who want to stay, who fit our program and our culture and who will thrive in it. Mm-hmm. Not people looking for the next best thing. So it's really important to get that athlete that has the character and the values that fit with what we do.
Makes sense.
Now, podcast, you touched on it a little bit with talent, but with the podcast being named When Hard Work Beats Talent, is there a specific story or any thing you've seen over the last 30 plus years of coaching where even on the recruiting trail, you're like, you know, that person has talent. And we've all been there. We always see, you know, whether it's in sports or business or life, saying that person has talent, but if their work ethic met that talent, then they would be unstoppable. Is there any story that you can recall that that makes you remember that?
I would say this. Not exactly. What I always say is talent isn't enough. Talent isn't enough. So my best example is going in, and this is the opposite of example of what you're asking, but I went in and watched Chase Capps. Okay. Chase Capps was not highly sought after. She was 16th in the country, maybe at JO's. She was not good on bars. She was okay on vault. And so not like a full all around athlete. And by not good, I mean, not yet.
Right.
So I went into the gym and I was mesmerized by her. I couldn't take my eyes off of her. She worked faster and harder than anyone else. There was no one else around her challenging her. She moved like the wind, and she had zero hesitation in anything she did. You could tell she had talent, but her work ethic was what was going to help that talent, you know, come out, flourish. We felt like our environment would help that grow. And so more so I go into places and think she has talent, but she works so hard. This is going to keep blooming. I have been in places certainly where someone's incredibly talented and moves a little bit slower, doesn't look like they have intentionality in what they're doing. And sure, if they worked harder, they might be even better. But work ethic is hard to change. Work ethic is inside you. It is something that, to me, it's intrinsic. It's something you're doing because that's who you are. And so someone can have all the talent in the world, but if they don't have the other side of it, it's tough to continue to get better in this sport. And I would also say that someone who works really hard can overcome a lack of talent in this sport, which, you know, a lot of people might say that's not possible, but I've seen it happen myself, you know, and I commend those people who outwork their own talent. Like, it's amazing what they can do.
Those are the people who end up being highly successful side of athletics too, because they realize that through their hard work, they can do more if they put in the effort and have that positive attitude, and they're just constantly trying to grind to get better. There's so many applications to personal and professional when it comes to just actually putting in the work and being the best version of yourself every day and having that right attitude about, hey, I might not be the best at this, but you're not going to outwork me. There's no one's going to do more solid work than me. And if you do that, you'll win more than you lose. And that's what it's about at the end of the day, is just winning the day.
Yep. Absolutely. I agree. With Wes and I in the insurance business, you know, we always get told those a lot. It's sometimes like when I tell you I'm out on the recruiting trail. You know, you might be out on the recruiting trail for a completely different reason. I'm out there asking for money. But, you know, we're going to get told no a lot. But in the insurance business, I always say it, you equate it to Hall of Fame numbers. When the Baseball Hall of Fame, you bat 300, you're in the Hall of Fame. You're getting out 70% of the time. Same in our business. You get out 70% of the time. However, if you can keep it with that Hall of Fame numbers and outwork the competition, then you're going to have a good career. And it sounds like it's the same thing with on your side as well, coach. You 100%. Just have to outwork everybody. One of the things that I've noticed going to your practice is you guys don't have an easy practice. It's not easy, especially when you get into the preseason and in the crux of the season. It's a hard practice. Do you guys make sure that you have hard practices come with easier days, lighter days, as the season goes on, because it's such a grind?
Oh yeah, we do something called tapering. So as we get closer to a meet, and you might hear this word tapering in the sport of swimming a lot, right? But as you get closer to the meet, you are lightening up the load, definitely in strength and conditioning, because on Friday, their legs have to feel like $1 million. And if they're sore, not a great, but they can't feel, they haven't done gymnastics in a long time. So it's kind of a process of weaning them down. The beginning of the week is always pretty difficult, and then weaning them down, to have a great, competition on the weekend. So we definitely do that in the preseason. It's a grind. It is morning conditioning, because they're working their way up to peaking really in January. We peak several times during the year. It's definitely methodical how we do it, but our philosophy has always been to come out hot at the beginning of the year. And for gymnastics, that means getting the number one score of all the schools on the first weekend. Like if you can solidify yourself right from the get-go as number one, there's a lot of things that accompany that, both politically and mentally. For our team, mentally for our team, the confidence, you know, you see Oklahoma, the number one spot, and meet two gets better. And so, you know, I've really put a lot of stock in that being our process. Other schools have different processes. Maybe it's a slow build for them. But for me, I've always found this to be the best strategy for our teams.
Awesome. Okay, so going on, one of our favorite things to do during competition day is to follow the athletes and see what the hashtag is for that day. You have different themes, different comp day themes. It's very fascinating. It's very awesome and enjoyment. So we try to guess the hashtags every chance we get. We always fall short. We never guess them, but we always have to ask when they come out. And so where did that come into play?
Okay, so yeah, well, we as coaches, you know, motivation is a huge part of our job. Inspiring them on meet day, huge part of our job. And so we have a team meeting every evening before the meet. And during that meeting, we certainly go over logistics, like this is when we need to be here and this is what we're doing. This is the lineup. To me, that's just logistics. And then we kind of go over a theme for the day. Like, this is what, you know, this is what we want to do tomorrow. This is going to put you in the right mindset. We've done different themes every year. You know this. This year we did movies. So we'd pick a certain movie and we'd play a clip from that movie the night before. And we'd relate it to the meet the next day and why it relates. And we may also relate it to where they are in the season or where we want their mindset to be, or, you know, all sorts of things like that. And it's also very educational for them, to be honest with you. You know, some of the movies we were picking, they'd never seen before. And then they'd go watch the movie because they were like, oh, that was cool. I want to go check it out. And so we've done numbers. We've done words. We've done famous athletes, you know, and pick a different athlete and kind of how, what their journey was. We've done songs. That one was great. Picked a different song for every meet. And, you know, lyrics can be really inspirational and things like that. We just try to pick a different theme every year and really run with it. And so the hashtag has to do with whatever movie or whatever theme that we picked. One year we picked symbols. I mean, that was 2020, the year of COVID, symbols. I should have had like a cross skull. That should have been the symbol for the year. But it's just inspirational because there's all these things in our world that we don't know about. Like numbers. If you pick a certain number, they have so many meanings, these numbers. It's like amazing the history behind numbers. And then they would learn a lot about it. And we would certainly use it to our advantage. Like if we needed Maggie Nichols to be a superstar the next day, we picked her favorite number for the number.
You're not stupid. Hey. You've done this before. You know what to do.
Right. And so anyway, there's certain moments that you can really grab on to that. But that's why the hashtag, and they make the hashtag. We don't. So we do this whole thing, and then the team gets together and they're like, let's do hashtag whatever, you know. A lot of times it has a cuss word in it.
I know. I've seen that one. I noticed that. I did notice there was one hashtag of LFG. So I got that one pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, which, hey, let's do it.
I would never direct them to do that.
No, for the record, Coach KJ Kindler is not directing them to have a hashtag with a cuss word in it.
Athletes make the decision.
Yeah.
Athletes make the decisions and we run with it.
Yeah.
And it's correct. Worked out.
Obviously.
And so, yeah, obviously.
Well, we thank you for being on here with us and taking time out of your day. Obviously, you're very busy with continuing to build winning teams year after year after year. It's not like you're just a one-hit wonder. You've done this now for decades of having success and building highly functional teams who go on and have success at each level of their athletic and personal lives. And so we appreciate you spending time with us today to kind of talk about that. I'm sorry that you're friends with Ryan. That is our cross to bear for both of us. So I commiserate in that with you, and we can discuss that sometime about how we can do better in our lives.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the time. I think you're in Dallas now with the U.S. Championships or Olympic trials coming up. Thank you very much. And with that said, we say goodbye.